Well, thank you. Thank you for being here. As the lovely Margot mentioned, I'm Mark Baldwin, principal trumpet, letting conductors think they run the orchestra since 1980. Today, we have our third candidate for the music director of the Rockford Symphony, Andrew Crust. Welcome.
Thank you very much. It's great to be here.
It's been a real joy working with you this week. I always like to start interviews, from my old radio gig, is what's your story? Where do you come from? Whence Andrew Crust start?
I can tell you have a voice for radio. I hadn't thought of that before.
Well, people have told me I have a face for radio and a voice for mime, but
there we go. Well, first of all, it's great to be here. Can you hear me? I can't tell if you can hear me. You've got me in the back. Beautiful. Thank you. It's been a wonderful week so far, and the orchestra's treated me very well, except for the brass section.
We do have a reputation to uphold, you understand.
That's right. So where am I from? I'm from the Midwest. I'm from Kansas City originally. Not terribly far from here, but currently I live in Vancouver, British Columbia, which is, you know, on this continent about as far as you can go.
Truth. Where in Vancouver? Well, in Vancouver, British Columbia. You told me Vancouver. Mm-hmm. Wake up, Mark. I'm here. How long have you been there?
Been there about 2.5 years, and I started my sort of Canadian side of my life when I did my master's at McGill, which is also where maybe some of you saw the first candidate, Yaniva Tar. He went to McGill as well. In fact, he told me about McGill. So if it wasn't for him, he's a friend. Otherwise, I would never talk about another candidate. that was my first connection. I stayed in Montreal for a good 4 years, I think, mm-hmm. and then now I'm on the other side of the country.
Where did music start for you? Where did it come from?
I think music started for me in the womb, honestly. I mean, I probably listened to the Beatles in the womb more than the average person listens to the Beatles. Mm-hmm. So I think I say that because I just had a great diversity of music in my upbringing, not necessarily the classical performance side of it. I didn't have anyone in my family that was a classical musician, but all of my family had a wide array of styles that they would like to listen to. My mom grew up quizzing me on the four great ladies of jazz, and mm-hmm. if I couldn't identify Nina Simone versus Ella Fitzgerald, Sarah Vaughan, or Billie Holiday, then mm-hmm. she looked at me like, you have some work to do, you know. but at the same time, you know, she blasted Alanis Morissette and the Mozart Requiem and, you know, mm-hmm. Eminem. Okay. And Christina Aguilera, and you know, my dad would introduce me to Louis Armstrong, and so mm-hmm. I had this this wide range. But I started playing the trumpet. He already mm-hmm. knows that. I started playing.
I liked him.
Yeah, at grade five, you know, mm-hmm. fifth grade, which is when you usually start in that area. But before that, I was already, I think, pretty musical. The story goes, I could sing Christine's aria from Phantom of the Opera when I was 4 years old, in the right octave.
Mm-hmm. Can you still?
Not
in the right octave?
I don't think so.
Yeah, interesting. I had a similar. My parents' tastes in music were quite wide ranging. I used to joke that my dad's Gregorian chant recordings were next to the Janis Joplin recordings. And the thing is, it's true. Yeah. So I understand that kind of upbringing. What drew you to the trumpet?
There already existed one in my house.
That's a good reason.
And, you know, if it wasn't for that little simple choice, who knows? I probably would be mm-hmm. an entirely different person, you know. But I did, you know, gravitate towards it, I think, in a way. You get to play the melody. You have a mm-hmm. it's a diverse instrument. You can play jazz. You can play classical. You can play a lot of different styles. But it was a purely practical choice by my dad, who wanted to be cheap.
Okay.
So it was already. He was a trumpet player before. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it might have been the fact that in the end I didn't really feel that was my destiny mm-hmm. that kind of moved me in the direction of conducting.
Okay. Where did you grow up? Where?
Kansas City. In the suburbs mm-hmm. on the Kansas side.
Yeah. Okay. All right. So you're a Midwesterner through and through.
That's right. Okay. Yep.
Now, in your initial going into music, were you more drawn towards jazz, classical? Where was it that you found your interest there?
For a time, I was more interested in jazz, but it was always a mix. In high school, I played in every ensemble I possibly could, but I also played, you know, Kansas City's got a great jazz scene.
Oh, yeah. Mm-hmm.
Charlie Parker's from there, Count Basie, mm. and there's a little district there, the 18th and Vine. I would go on Monday nights and play with the house band and the open mic night kind of thing. Mm-hmm. And I was completely unprepared for that as a 17-year-old. I did it anyway. They would call out a tune, and I maybe didn't know it in the right key, and I would just try my best. So I played that. I also played a little piano. I was in a band. I composed nonstop. Mm-hmm. This was before, you know, I used my computer mostly as a tool at that time.
Sure.
So I got into that, and it was a mix. But by the time I went to university, I really went more towards the classical side, just as a practical side. But I kept playing in the jazz band. I was the second trumpet, which was the mm-hmm. improviser.
Oh, yeah. Right?
Yeah. So that's what I enjoyed. And I still today find that not a lot of musicians can improvise. I'm not just talking about jazz. Mm-hmm. I'm talking mm-hmm. about in any style. And that's not how it was in the days of Bach and Beethoven and Mozart.
No, not at all.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and so I think there's something lost there that we should all put back into our music education.
It is interesting you bring that up as a bit of an aside, that these days most people think if you're a classical musician, there is no improvisation. You know, you don't do it at all. Whereas through the 16, 17, 18, 1900s, improvisation was kind of expected, at least if you were a major soloist.
Absolutely.
And really, what would it be, say, Beethoven, or in that era when composers started writing their cadenzas?
Yeah, I think so.
And saying, you know, do this. And so now we have this idea that, well, Beethoven wrote, you know, I can't write anything better than Beethoven, so let's go with that. But it kind of also defeats the purpose of what the cadenza was initially.
And certainly Beethoven didn't follow his own rules when he was performing. It was this chance to improvise, and there are legendary stories, of course, about him having battles with other composers. And Mozart did the same thing, of course, if you've seen Amadeus. Mm-hmm. He completely insults, is it Salieri or someone else in that film? I can't remember.
Salieri.
It turns the music upside down, and, you know, so it's a way of, actually, that's how Beethoven first conquered Vienna. Was he showed up there and he showed his skills as an improviser and just blew everybody out of the water. And even, you know, Chopin, all of his pieces are improvisations that he happened mm-hmm. to write down after the fact. And there happen to be many, many versions of every nocturne and everything like this because he never stopped changing it. Mm-hmm. 'Cause every time he would make it different. And now we're kind of stuck in this. The farther things get back in the past, I think the more we put it on a pedestal and it's this pure thing that we can't touch. But that's not how it was at the time.
Mm-hmm. Isn't you bring that up? I wish I could. I am terrible with remembering names, so remember that, Michael. There's a wonderful pianist. I can't remember his name, but he has these teaching tutorials that I watch sometimes. And he's talking about how he improvises his own cadenzas, and he was playing a concert. And he said, unfortunately, he was playing that concert on the same night Star Trek IV came out in the theaters. And he's a huge Trekkie. And so in the middle of his cadenza, he goes, bum, ba-dum, bum, 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 bum. And the orchestra almost lost it. The conductor had no idea because he had no idea what Star Trek was. But you would do that. You would throw in things like that.
Absolutely,
when you were improvising. When was it that conducting started to become more appealing to you?
Well, I mean, I mentioned all of the things I did in high school as a musician, but I didn't really understand the world of orchestra as much as I did listen to it. I didn't know what that job was, you know, what are the career prospects for that. I didn't have any teachers, unfortunately, that connected me to this world. So mm-hmm. I discovered that in my undergrad when I first started playing in orchestras. I mentioned to you the first thing I ever played was John Adams' Short Ride in the Fast Machine, which
Ouch.
Is not the first thing you play in an orchestra. It was not prepared for that. But I, you know, sitting in the back of the orchestra, mm-hmm. as you do, and counting a lot of rests as a brass player, mm-hmm. you get to look out at this expanse here in front of you, and you get to listen, and you get to think a lot until you lose track of which bar you are, 75 or 76, and
then,
you know, now you miss your entrance. But the point is, you get to listen, and I started having these ideas, you know, it wasn't so much I could do that, it was I would like to do that. And the reason is, that person gets to choose the music. They get to spend actually all of their life thinking about the big picture and thinking about not just one instrument, but all of them. And I already kind of had that personality. in undergrad, you know, I was less interested in going and practicing trumpet. I was more interested in studying scores or sitting in the library and taking out CDs and listening to composers I had never heard before. So I realized at some point you have these two paths as a musician. Well, either, you know, if you're doing performing or conducting, you can sit in a practice room and work on your one instrument for the rest of your life, which is great. You become a master of something. Or you can spend your time alone and in your own room looking at the whole score and thinking about it from a bigger perspective. It's more of a mental sort of thing rather than a physical thing. And that just attracted me. And the fact that conductors also have to read a lot about the history of these composers and the historical context of the composers. And then, again, I mentioned choosing the repertoire. I think that's the favorite thing for me about conducting. And if you're in an orchestra, the sad fact is you usually don't get to do that unless you build your own orchestra or you do chamber music. You know, I wanted to decide, because I just love certain music, I wanted to share it with people, and I was interested in making these connections between music. So, you know, there are plenty of things that all it takes a lot to be a conductor, and there's almost no conductor that can do all of those things well. Mm-hmm. So there are plenty of things I don't love about it, but other things that are quite nice. You get to travel and meet new people and go to new cities. So I think it was a good fit in the end. And also, I was pretty mad that trumpet didn't have concertos by Mozart and Beethoven and Stravinsky and all of these things. You truth. Feel that way as well?
Truth, yes. Every time I hear the Korngold Violin Concerto, I said, why didn't you write a trumpet concerto? But anyway, there's so many different directions I'd like to go here, and we have limited time. What is your philosophy in programming for an orchestra? And would you be, or do you feel that it's a different way of programming for, say, an orchestra that has 6 concerts, 12 concerts, 24 concerts? How would you go about that?
Well, it all has to be based on your local context. You know, where are you? What kind of orchestra is it? What are the players, what are they used to playing? So maybe there's something that's been left out of the repertoire for a long time that the orchestra needs to get back in the repertoire. You know, a lot of orchestras never play Baroque music. And people love Baroque music, and it's a great workout for the orchestra in a lot of ways. But I'm getting into the weeds here. I would say in a more general sense, you have to think about what am I offering to the community, not what do I want to conduct. Otherwise, it'd be all Mahler and Strauss and Brahms all the time.
And I'd be very happy.
Yeah, you know, but it's not about that. A community has a diverse array of people with different interests, and there may be some people who think, I just want Rachmaninoff and Beethoven, but your job is also to convince them gently that they may like to expand those horizons. And so, you know, contemporary programming is a part of that. And I'm always surprised sometimes to find that people think Stravinsky's contemporary. The Rite of Spring was 1913, was it? Mm-hmm. So to bring people into this world of a diverse array of composers, but also just to serve this goal of what is an orchestra. We are here to provide as many experiences as possible of the greatest music of all time. And that's not just the 4 B's or the 3 B's, right? There are also living composers who I know people will find palatable and enjoyable. So you have to kind of take stock of where am I? What do people here like? What do they not like? What kind of things could I bring that they're going to discover for the very first time? But also keep the orchestra happy, keep the orchestra performing these pieces like Beethoven, which are very good for keeping in shape. It's like an Olympian, you know, doing your fundamentals. That's what Beethoven and Mozart are. And I think we always have to play that stuff. I hope 100 years from now we're still doing that. I mean, how long ago did Mozart live and we're still doing? Speaking of Star Trek, I'm a big Trekkie too. Mm-hmm. And I love how they play Mozart and Schubert on the starship with Lieutenant Data. He's like, which violinist should I be today? Oyster Rock? or he can just program himself. But that being said, you know, maybe 500 years from now, no one will play Beethoven, and that's fine. Monteverdi used to be the Beethoven of his time. He was seen as the greatest composer ever. How many of you have heard Monteverdi live? And that's fine. You know, we have to also realize we move into the future, but I think Beethoven is still very relevant. Yeah.
Well, it's interesting. You talk about, you know, how composers come in and out of fashion over the years. You know, if you're done any reading in music or gone to music school, you know that Bach was thought of as a third-rate composer in his day. First-rate organist, improviser, but Telemann was the man, you know. But now Telemann is, I hope, having a bit of a resurgence because he didn't write bad stuff, you know.
If he even wrote it all. There's a story. If you actually measure the amount of time it would take to physically write out all of the Telemann scores, mm-hmm. it's longer than he lived.
He is thought of as being extremely prolific. How do you go about, what's your philosophy in introducing newer music, introducing music from different cultures, different styles? You know, our symphonic orchestra, of course, is a European tradition. It's a Western European tradition. And as more music becomes more popular, it becomes integrated into the tradition. And you have kind of I don't want to say homogenization, but, you know, how do you get, say, Latin styles or this within the symphonic context?
Well, think about what makes American music really interesting. It's that diversity, right? You know, we would not have rock and roll if we didn't have, really going back to African music, right, from the continent and then coming over here. Think about jazz, you know, and how that has infused itself into all different styles of music. So I think that's happening with classical music. Of course, in the days of Beethoven, they thought this diversity was, I'll write a Turkish march with some little triangles and cymbals. I've never been to Turkey. There's no way I'm ever going to go there. But now we live in this multicultural world, and so I think that blending, honestly, it's really the only way that we can create anything new, that and technology. Because when you think about the 1500s and 1600s, you had this vast expanse of newness that you could achieve down throughout the centuries, and you weren't allowed to write a tritone, for example, or you weren't allowed, even having thirds in harmony was a new idea. And then all these other new things came, and synthesizers and recording technology. Well, now what is new? I mean, maybe an NFT or something. The only way we can be new is by adding more genres together and mixing all of these different ideas, and perhaps some new technology will appear as well. But I think it's important because people also understand contemporary music, and when it has a bad name, right? People get afraid of that, but that actually represents a really diverse palette of styles, from the most gritty and intellectual music that you need an advanced degree to understand, to the most simple folk kind of music, you know, that is almost pop music in a classical sense. Mm-hmm. So I encourage everyone to not be afraid of that word, because that represents such a massive style. And when I hear people say, "Oh, classical, I like classical music for studying, it's relaxing," I say, "Why don't you listen to Shostakovich Leningrad Symphony and tell me that that's relaxing? Like,
try to study to that."
Yeah. So, and that's the same thing with contemporary art of any kind. It's this diverse range. So it's then the music director's job to choose things that sometimes will challenge people, sometimes not. Sometimes it's on a subject that people immediately comprehend, some current event or some social movement that we're all aware of. There's music written for it. I guarantee that.
Kind of going into this idea of exposing people to different musics and kind of piggybacking on that into the idea of education. How do you see the orchestra as a tool for education, not only for the concert goer, but for kids, getting kids into music? I mean, we see nothing but cutbacks in music programs. I was very fortunate in that I came through a very, very good educational program. I grew up in Villa Park. And I had a fantastic elementary school band. I had a fantastic junior high. Matter of fact, when I was in junior high, we had a jazz band, and we were playing all the Sammy Nestico charts. We were playing Hey Burner, Basie Straight Ahead. These are not easy charts. My junior high band was cutting them. I mean, and I had a fantastic experience in high school. How do you see our role as an orchestra in combating the lack of musical education?
If not us, then who? I mean, it's not going to be the government. You know, it's not going to be really the general public. It's quite sad, I think, and I don't want to go down a dark path here, but I do feel that music participation as a whole is massively down. I was telling this story just the other day. I'm repeating myself a lot this week, as it will happen. I'm reading a book by Shostakovich, and he's lamenting the fact that the music participation was so down in his time, and it was probably in the 60s or something. But he was referencing a book from the 1880s in which there was this little village, tiny village in Russia, and all of the local political people, there was like the chief of police and the mayor and the city councilman or whatever, they all played Mendelssohn Octet together. And he's in the 60s saying, imagine now if you could find, you know, a group of these people, could they do anything? Well, imagine 2022. Can anyone in government play anything? Do they even know that? I mean, I'm from Kansas City. The Kansas City Chiefs football coach, there's this hilarious and sad video of him in the locker room after some game saying, not all Mozart's paintings were masterpieces, but they sold for $1 million anyway. This man is a multimillionaire, right? Mm-hmm. So we don't have this appreciation in our culture anymore. So I think, you know, the orchestra is responsible for that. There's nobody else doing it. So and it's not only adults, children, it's adults. If the parents are not telling their children that this is important, if the parents are not playing this music at home, they have no chance. Their only chance is when they come in and see the orchestra live in a school concert, or when the string quartet goes out into the schools or something like that. And so it's massively important. If you believe that music makes lives better and it's not just entertainment, then this is, I think, our number one task. It's not so important to find the world's best soloist and all of these things. It's more important to realize that people are losing their love for and understanding of music on a massive scale. And so it's our job to solve that problem.
If I could be a little bit, we could be a little bit more concrete about that. How do you see it going into schools? How, given the budget, okay, you can do whatever you want. What would you do?
Well, it's all about doing it, participation, playing an instrument and singing. And I did this thing in Memphis, which I can't claim credit for inventing, but it was the best example I've ever seen of this when I worked in Memphis. There's this guy named Carl Orff. He was no longer alive. You might know Carmina Burana. But he also was famous for his educational system, which he created, which involved performing and playing and learning. So there is the largest ORF teacher community in Memphis in the world for some strange reason. And all of these elementary schools, there must have been 15 of them, have these teachers who train their kids in this system. And we would come as an orchestra with about 40 or 35 people, and we'd go in their gymnasium or their lunchroom. And they will have been working for weeks at a time. And some of them play xylophone. Some of them sing in a choir. Some of them danced with little fans. Some of them, whatever. We actually played with them and accompanied them. And their parents would pack into this place. The acoustics are terrible. It still smells like, you know, elementary school pizza or something. But they performed with us, and I think that's the difference. If you can get people actually physically doing it, it's going to be more meaningful. And so I think that's important, and to enable the local school teachers to give them as many resources as possible, but to go into their space and not just to invite them into yours. So, you know, we have, I say we, the Rockford Symphony has a very interesting platform online that I recognized about choosing musical instruments. It's like a whole hub on the website. That each instrument has its own page. There's a lot of information there. I think that's very valuable. But I think as often as possible, you got to get into the schools and get kids performing with you.
Where do you see the orchestra? And we've touched on this a little bit, but going forward, where do you see the orchestra? How does it become more important in the community? How does it become more of a leader in cultural understanding in that?
Well, I mean, in a utopian society, orchestras never have to want for money, right? Somebody's funding it, the government or someone, and the concert hall is always full of people, and the general public understands the value of that. But as I said, you know, we're I think people know the value of the arts. If anything, the last few years taught us that, when the only thing we could do was watch movies and listen to music, which is art, I think. Obviously, even Netflix is artistic if you're watching the right stuff and not only doing that. So, you know, I don't know how to achieve that. I think one of the problems in classical music is we're stuck in the past too much. We don't know how to adapt. And we're somehow obsessed with this old European model of we need to... It's all about the artistic quality, and if we bring, which is important, but if we build it, they will come. You know, if we do if we bring the best soloists and we have the best artistic product, if they don't come, then that's their fault. Then they don't have any taste, right? So they should just stay home. Well, it's more of an evangelistic situation now. We have to just be out there convincing people, and that's the reality. Maybe in the New York Philharmonic or the Chicago Symphony, you might think doesn't have that issue. They also do. Maybe they didn't in the past. You know, many people in this room probably know who Toscanini and Bernstein are, but ask a 20-year-old. They don't know who these people were. They name one classical musician. Maybe Yo-Yo Ma. Mm-hmm. Maybe not. Maybe not even John Williams. So, how do we achieve that? It's a big discussion. But I think we have to be accessible. We have to bring people in and teach them that they shouldn't be afraid. That you don't need any knowledge to really appreciate this. Although we'll try to give you some knowledge. I like to speak from the podium and try and bring people into the world a little bit, especially if it's contemporary. But you have to assume that at every concert, even if there are 2,000 people in that hall, there are people who don't know that Beethoven was deaf. There are people that don't know what century Mozart lived in, you know. So you have to speak to every different kind of person, both the expert and the complete novice.
I want to change gears a bit here, because I really have been going on about the orchestra. I want to talk a little bit about you.
Nobody wants to know that.
Oh, you don't know Rockford.
You say that in a very menacing way.
So, what was your first conducting gig?
Well, my first job was in Portland, Maine, like full-time job as the assistant conductor there in Portland, Maine. It's a great town. I don't know if any of you have been there. The best food anywhere. And that was, you know, throw you right into the water, because it's not that kind of job is not what you learn in school necessarily. In school, you're learning how to make the music sound really great, how to be a great musician. And then suddenly you're doing these education shows and these pops shows. And I don't know if many of you are aware, but oftentimes those are done on one rehearsal. The musicians are just so good that they come and they show up.
Try doing a John Williams concert on one rehearsal. We've done it.
And, you know, that's why I'm happy to do this film music on a sort of a main series concert, because John Williams is brutal. And
yeah.
For you, but for the violins, too, they have thousands of notes. So you have to learn how to do that in that job, and you have to learn how to kind of put your ego aside, because suddenly you're in school, you're doing your dissertation, and you're thinking all these lofty thoughts. And now you have to wear a T-Rex suit and conduct Jurassic Park.
There isn't a class for that in college, is there?
No. There absolutely is not. So it's a learning process, and I think that's one of the good things about the American system. You know, in Germany and Europe, you continue this sort of academic world. When you become an assistant, all you do is you assist great conductors, you learn the standard repertoire, you never speak really to the public. You don't get that many chances to perform. But in the U.S. system, you're now learning every single style from Tina Turner to John Williams to American folk music, whatever it might be, so that now you're ready for any possible situation. I know some people who have come from Europe and tried to get these U.S. assistant jobs, and they are very confused. What do I have to do? I have to play the washboard in front of people? So it's a full education, I'll put it that way.
So where to from there?
So I was there for really just two seasons, I think, and then I went to the Memphis Symphony, which I was telling you about some of my experiences. Very similar thing there. Memphis is so connected to the king, Elvis. He's everywhere. I couldn't escape from seeing him, and but also such a great history of civil rights and soul music and Motown and all of these things. And so I was assistant conductor there, but I also ran the Youth Symphony there.
Mm-hmm.
And I also at that time worked with the National Youth Orchestra of the USA, which is a Carnegie Hall organization. Every year they play in Carnegie Hall and then they tour a different continent. And I was Asia the time I was there.
Nice.
Which was great. I went got to go to China and South Korea and Taiwan and experience that very different side of classical culture. And then from Memphis, I went to Vancouver.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. So you have lived in every extent of this continent, basically.
Well, I got to get a gig in Mexico, and I'll be good to go.
There we go. Just very quickly, just because this just struck me, what's different about Canada than America? What are the what are the differences? I mean, we've seen all, you know, the borders are closed, and Canadians are polite, and you know, but just kind of just because I'm kind of interested, what do you see?
I always think of Canada as like America light, you know, like there are everything is just a little bit calmer, and the you know, in the U.S. it's every possible thing that could possibly happen is going to happen to the max, right? And Canada's just a little more chill. And you know, obviously there's this cliche of Canadians being very friendly, and they say sorry all the time. Sorry. They do that, actually. But, of course, it's a diverse country. You have Quebec, which is French-Canadians, and that's a distinct culture. But, you know, I don't know. I think it's if the U.S. wasn't here to kind of absorb all of that, maybe they would be just like us. But I think they can kind of sit on top there and just relax a little bit. And it's calmer. Everything is a little slower. Toronto is, they call it, you know, the New York of Canada, but it's nowhere near that level of chaos.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
So I enjoy it. It's relaxed. But, of course, every region within Canada, I think the thing people are proudest of in Canada, I was just mentioning this before, there was a poll that was taken, and across Canada, they didn't say hockey. They said multiculturalism. And mm-hmm. it's a very diverse country, and that's great. I walk down the street, and I hear every language imaginable.
Mm-hmm. Well, I came up when I was asking you a question yesterday. I came up, and you and Michelle Lakis were speaking French. Now, personally, I thought they were talking about violin things, which I don't understand any more than I understand French. But so when do you learn French?
I learned it in Quebec, and she is Quebecois.
Mm-hmm.
And I, you know, it's not easy to learn it if you're a lot of Americans go there and they study at McGill and they don't even bother. They stay in the little area around McGill. But I wanted to have that immersion. And as a conductor, it's helpful if you have languages because if you ever do opera, you've got to know some Italian and German and French and at least how to pronounce it.
Right.
And, you know, you look at scores of Mahler or Strauss, they're all written in German. All the indications are in German. Usually it's Italian, and everybody has to learn what adagio and allegro non troppo and perdendosi and morendo and all of these many, many things mean. But you also need to know all of that in all the other languages. Also the names of instruments in all of those languages and the names of the notes. And so to me, it was an opportunity, and I worked very hard. Of course, Quebecois French is slightly different than Parisian
right.
French,
mm-hmm.
so I can kind of flip between the two.
Mm-hmm. What do you do when you don't have a baton in your hand? How do you spend the few remaining minutes in your life when you're not studying scores and dealing with recalcitrant trumpet players and all that kind of stuff?
These days it's not much time to do anything else. But I love living in Vancouver because it's such a nature city. I don't know if any of you have been there. I see bald eagles flying from my balcony. You know, I can go out in the park and take a hike and these kind of things. But I think musicians need hobbies to really understand. It's like if you're an actor and you never have any hobbies. Well, how do you know how to be a play a taxi driver or a doctor, or how do you know how to feel? You have to experience these things. So I like to read a lot. Right now I'm reading a book by Arthur C. Clarke, Rendezvous with Rama.
Oh, yeah, that's
like
a good one.
Sci-fi, and I like reading
classic.
You know, nonfiction, and don't spoil it for me, please. I love art. I'm a visual artist. I like that to me is a way to make something concrete and to complete a project because, mm-hmm. You know, you don't make sound as a conductor. You only influence the sound. And I often feel that I'm not really a creative artist. And a lot of people would say, yes, you are. But think about it. You're not really. I'm not trying to come up with my own interpretation of this piece. I'm trying to do exactly what the composer wanted. Because the music notation is vague. As strange and complicated as it looks, it is kind of vague. And so it's our job to try and find out from hundreds of years later what they wanted. Music, art is this concrete thing that you can create. So I like to do that when I've got time. And I'm a big fan of film and TV, and so that's one of the reasons I'm loving this week is all these classic film scores we're doing.
Boy, just a couple things you said there. If we had time, boy, would I love to go off and into a tangent on conducting and interpretation and what is creative, because even in conducting over the decades, the conductor's role in what he is to do with music has changed so much. I mean, you could generally say Toscanini was one of the first to say, okay, here's the score. You know, his famous quote about Beethoven 3, you know, says that's Napoleon, it's Beethoven. You know, he says it's simply allegro con moto to me, you know. Whereas other conductors, if you go back to Mengelberg and earlier, they would do everything with scores. And when you get into... Just for a moment, because I want to open this up to some questions before we run out of time, and I want to give you a chance to say a few things if you want. When you're interpreting a piece of music, when you have it in front of you, realizing that interpretations have changed over the years, we're looking back, you know, say, if we're doing Mahler, you know, we're looking back at a man who died in, what was it, 1911?
1911, yeah.
Or we go back earlier. The world was different. The aesthetic of music was different. What musicians were expected to do was different. So when we, as 21st century? As Star Trek.
The rendezvous with Rama there.
Yeah, exactly. As 21st century musicians, we look at this. What is the proper interpretation? What was the composer's intent?
This is such, I mean, this is one of the reasons I love music, is trying to ponder these questions. And that's also why I love going to an art museum. You look at a painting, that's a photograph, in a way, of the time. But it's also, you're seeing this through the eyes of a person at that time. They interpret the world in a certain way. And it's really hard. But not only do you have to read a lot about the person and the culture at the time, but then you have to ask, okay, if this is how they played it, are we obliged to do the same thing? And to what extent are we obliged to do the same thing? Maybe this person would have loved to have it this way. I think we would be shocked at the poor quality of orchestras that people like Beethoven had to deal with. Some of these premieres of the symphonies were, I'm sure, an absolute mess, and that's what you hear. You know, and I think they would come to America and say, "What? There's a great orchestra in every town." They're better than this, like the Leipzig Orchestra. To hear the Berlin Philharmonic or the New York Philharmonic now would probably just blow their minds, and to hear their own music played in that way, they would probably Bach probably would have loved synthesizers and all of these different possibilities. But we don't know that, so we have to kind of question how far can we go outside of what they would have wanted. There are groups which play it exactly like they wanted, the same size of orchestra. But Brahms' Second Symphony, I think the premiere had like 40 players. I don't think he wanted that. I think also Mozart, there are letters to his dad where he was very happy to have a large orchestra, and yet we always think of playing it very small. So it's this discussion, this decision in your head, do I know enough about this person that I can make some choices that they might have appreciated?
Mm-hmm.
And that's a very interesting decision to make. Yeah.
Hey, especially when you go back, you're familiar with, I don't know if you have heard it, Mahler's reorchestration of Beethoven 9.
Yeah, that goes a bit far for me.
But I love it. there was, I think Detroit did it at one point. I mean, there's 8 horns. And he has one point, all 8 of them are bells up, I mean, just screaming out the, and it's kind of like take Beethoven and mark it over with Dayglow. You know, you wouldn't want to hear it all the time, but every now and again, it's pretty cool.
Well, and that tells you something about Mahler, because if he thought he could do that to Beethoven, then surely he would be okay if you did that to his music. And he actually wrote, if when I die something isn't quite right, you have the right to change it.
He did it. But also Mahler was one of the first to be so specific. I mean, looking at a Mahler part, whether it be trumpet or violin, is like reading a novel. I mean, he just, the instructions were...
All in German, too. And mm-hmm. things like, don't be sentimental.
Yeah.
Or don't you dare take any time here, directly in time.
Exactly.
He
exactly.
even tells the conductor how to beat, because he was a conductor as well. Yeah.
It's kind of interesting. It's like the old, Handel's Messiah, done by Beecham. Again, huge orchestra, choir of 500, organ, everything. And, you know, musical scholars and historians are having the vapors. But I defy anyone to listen to that and listen to that Hallelujah chorus and not just want to run through a brick wall because you are so hyped up by it.
And I think you have to adapt to the sound, the ears that we have in present time. And we may not appreciate something in the same way as a person who lived in the 1700s. When you think about, there's this book by Aldous Huxley, The Doors of Perception, and he talks about, for a person in the medieval period, they used, unless they were super rich, they used colors from natural dyes around them, right? So the palette was very limited, and the clothing they would wear, it was all very uniform. So going into a church and seeing stained glass windows, they were transformed into this mystical experience, this like religious experience. And the same thing was true for hearing music that wasn't just some folk band in the street. That wasn't all around them all the time. So hearing an orchestra or an organ was this monumental experience to them. And now, look at all the colors in this room, you know, and we have these bright orange construction cones everywhere, and you go to the grocery store and there's music playing. And so I think we actually have to adapt some things to our modern ears, and maybe that means some things are a little more bombastic, or maybe it's the opposite.
And some of the things I don't think we realize how spoiled we are as people from the 20th century, where it's really only, if you look back at it, a fairly recent innovation that you can go and listen to anything you want to by 30 different orchestras at the touch of a button. You know, you want to hear Beethoven 9 five times in a row, go for it. If you wanted to hear Beethoven 9 five times 200 years ago, you probably wouldn't live long enough to be able to get to five concerts that played Beethoven 9.
And that's, as all technology, that's a good and a bad thing, right? Because we take it for granted.
Exactly. Okay, I want to, I see we're coming up on the time here. Questions? Any questions? Sir?
Ah.
Ah, yes, Lima, Ohio.
I love this softball question. Thank you very much. Yeah, so I'm also the music director of the Lima Symphony, Lima, Ohio. If you're familiar with it, it's near Columbus and Cincinnati and these places. And they have this wonderful program, Project Noteworthy. There's a teacher who helped coordinate it with us, and we went into the schools, and the kids wrote words, like kind of poems that were going to be songs. And then they actually, together with the teacher, wrote the melody to these songs. And the prompt was sort of, how do we feel during this pandemic? You know, let's get out some of these feelings and emotions. And one of them was like, I'm shattered like a glass, you know, and they're kind of these deep emotions that these kids are feeling, or are feeling alone or feeling detached and all of these things. And they wrote them into melodies. Then we had a composer that we hired compose accompaniment to that for the orchestra. We recorded the accompaniment, and then we gave them that recording, and then they recorded the songs as a class over that accompaniment, and then we put it all together. And so now we have this song. And so the kids, again, it's the participation that I really loved about that. They're involved in the process. They suddenly feel like they're composers, and they get to perform with the orchestra and express their feelings. And so that's like everything, all in one. I really, really loved that. And that was thanks to a grant that we were able to do that. But I think it's something that could be replicated in many different places. And it's better to me than showing up and playing some music, right? It's getting them truly involved in the process. So I loved that. I hope we can keep doing it. Yeah.
Any other questions? Yes, ma'am. Oh, so getting more music by women composers.
Yeah.
And really that goes back to just diversity of any kind of composer, but particularly
right.
This case.
Well, you know, orchestras and opera companies and ballets are very much stuck in the past more than a lot of organizations, and much slower to adapt. And I think finally whether it was by force or because we believe in it, we are moving, you know, into this future. And you say they're not Beethoven. Well, they would have been Beethoven, but they weren't allowed to be Beethoven, right? The women were not allowed to achieve those heights. And, of course, there would have been a female Isaac Newton, and name a thing, but it wasn't allowed at the time. So finally, you know, now we have a lot of great living composers who are going to achieve that status and already have. But yes, I believe it's important. I always have, not only women, but composers of color, diverse backgrounds. You know, coming up soon, you're doing this Dinuk Wijeratne Tabla Concerto, which I'm also doing in Ohio next season, which the public there doesn't know yet, but that's, you know. So I think it's not only a responsibility, but there's just great music there. I love to do Coleridge Taylor, who was a black composer from the UK. And, you know, people like Fanny Mendelssohn apparently was just as good a composer as her brother, if not better, and she was discouraged from doing it. Alma Mahler, Gustav Mahler's wife, was discouraged from being a composer. And so how many people have we lost? But I absolutely believe it's important, and I know that this symphony already has had a Women in Music series. I don't think it's a one-off thing. You know, we did last month in Ohio, we did the Black History Month concert and involved some spoken word artists to do poetry after the concert, the little poetry reading event. And we had an MC who wrote original poems for the process. And that's also a way of bringing new people into the hall and people who may not care about Beethoven. But if you're playing a living female composer, now you've got my attention. So it's the right thing to do on every level. So I think all of these candidates you're going to see are on the same side of this issue, I would hope. And that's just sort of where we are now in the present day, thankfully, finally.
Okay. Yes, ma'am. So why Rockford?
Yeah, well, I mean, that's a question that is better to ask now that I've been here than people ask you that before you show up. And you're like, well, I don't really know yet. I've done some research, but I mean, things about the organization already attracted me, and I didn't know much about the city, although I do know some people who are from here and who have played in the orchestra. I know someone who actually came up through the Youth Symphony, a trumpet player, Peter Haslett. We can talk about that later. But, you know, I actually really like working in communities that are not places where people take the arts for granted, like Chicago or New York. You know, New York has everything you could possibly ever dream of, and most people just stay home. Whereas, like Kansas City, which is obviously bigger than Rockford, but it's a smaller place, people are obsessed with what they have to offer, right? They really support it. They go above and beyond to support what they have because they don't take it for granted. And so I found the same is true here. Everyone I met is telling me how valuable this institution is. And if they weren't telling me that, I would be a little worried. Like maybe this is just something that they're sustaining with artificial life here, you know, that doesn't belong, but it seems to have a great support. And I'm from this region. I know kind of how people think and work in this area. It's my blood. So I still haven't learned as much as I you know, would if I took this job. But Carrie's not here, is he? I got a tour from someone who happens to know every inch of this entire town.
Carrie. Oh, yeah.
Yeah, so I've learned a lot. But I think everybody comes in really not knowing much, and that's why you have a full week here, and you meet as many people as you can, and it's been a great process so far.
We're almost out of time, so I want to give you a few minutes if you have anything more you'd like to say to us.
I don't know exactly, other than, you know, this is an exciting time. I hope you're all, obviously, if you're here, you're quite engaged. But this is a time to kind of figure out where are we going, what is an orchestra in the 21st century, but also in this city, right? And I hope you all make your voices heard and come and talk to the candidates, and because we want to know what you think and what you think the future should be here. And that'll give us a better idea of what we would be getting into and what kind of projects we could have. But, you know, I would say it's really exciting. It's a time to reassess what this orchestra can be and where we can go moving forward. And it's you should be proud of what you have here as well. It's a great orchestra. As many of you know, not all of them live in the area, but that's normal. But when they're here, they are really engaged and they really care about the process, and it's not something that just happens, you know, to have an orchestra like this. It really takes the support of people like you who care. And even if you don't really love something on the program, show up anyway. Yeah, and tell your friends, because it will not continue to exist without the support of people who really care about it. So it's a fun time for the city. I hope you're all enjoying the process. And it's been great to be here. Yeah, well, thanks for the chat.
Andrew Crust, thank you very much for being here.